Good afternoon. My name is Tawna Szymanski, and I am the Executive Director and Legal Director of Communication First. My pronouns are she and her, and I am a white woman with long, wavy brown hair. I'm wearing glasses, and I have a wonky left eye. I'm wearing a black sweater today, and the Communication First logo is displayed behind me. I'm thrilled to welcome everyone to this one-of-a-kind event called Running for Office with a Speech Disability. We have four panelists today who have agreed to share their experiences in electoral politics. All four have speech-related disabilities, including one full-time augmentative and alternative communication, or AAC, user. Because we are a nonprofit 501c3 organization, I'm required to include a disclaimer about this topic. Nothing about this event should be construed to mean Communication First is endorsing or supporting any candidate for elected office in the past, present, or future. As a 501c3, we do not engage in partisan electoral activities, and this is a strictly nonpartisan event. Before I introduce our panel, first, a few words about logistics and accessibility. To turn on live captions, click on the CC button at the bottom of the Zoom window. You can have the captions appear either at the bottom of your screen or in a separate window. Second, American Sign Language interpretation is being provided. To make the interpreter more visible on your screen, you can pin or spotlight them so they are larger. Third, this is a webinar and not a meeting, so you won't be able to see the other attendees or use the chat box. Attendees were asked to submit questions to our panelists in advance. If we have time and the panelists are willing, we may take additional questions through the Q&A box in the webinar. Fourth, we are recording this webinar, and we do hope to have the recording and a corrected transcript available in the future. I am now very pleased to introduce our amazing panel. First up is India Oakes, who is an attorney with the US government. And we believe she may be the first full-time augmentative and alternative communication, or AAC, user to have run for elected office in the United States. Last year, she ran in an extremely tight race for the school board of her son's school district in Anne Arundel County, Maryland. India also happens to be the chair of my board of directors at Communication First, and is a single parent of an 11-year-old son. She lives in Annapolis, Maryland. Coleman Watson is a candidate for the US Senate in Florida. Before experiencing a sudden stroke in February of 2020, which resulted in aphasia, Coleman was a managing partner of Watson LLP, which is a law firm focused on civil rights, patent, trademark, and copyright litigation, and government investigations. He's handled more than 200 cases in federal, state, and administrative courts as a lead attorney, who is licensed to practice law in California, Florida, Georgia, and New York. That is a lot of bar exams. He lives with his wife and two children in Orlando, Florida. Next up, we have Angelica Vega, who graduated with an honors degree in philosophy from American University last summer. Angelica has interned at Emily's List, providing services for political campaigns across the country, and for Representative Frank Pallone of New Jersey. As an Afro-Latina with multiple disabilities, including a speech disability, she is hoping to pave a way for others like her to thrive. Angelica is a member of Communication First Advisory Council and is currently a law fellow of the Coelho Center for Disability Law, Policy, and Innovation at Loyola Law School. She lives in New Jersey. And finally, Sasha Bittner. Sasha has been active in politics her whole life. She is currently a commissioner on the San Francisco Disability and Aging Services Commission and a delegate to her state party, on which she has served on the Disability and Legislation Committees in leadership roles. She lives in San Francisco, California. And today, Sasha is using a revoicer today who is named Annika. So I am going to stop sharing slides at this point, and I'm going to invite each of the participants to make brief opening statements. And I'm going to encourage them as they do these to describe themselves visually for people with vision disabilities, and if they wish to tell us their pronouns. And let's start with India.
Hi, everyone. And a thank you to Tana M. Communication First for putting the spotlight on an issue rarely addressed in society. I am India Oaks, pronouns she, her, and I am a white cis female in my 40s with brown hair going just below the shoulder, wearing a peach suit jacket covering up a white shirt with the words, "Play like a champion today" on it. I know we have a lot to delve into today when it comes to running for office with a speech disability or any disability in general if you think about it, but just to open, I will say the exact same thing I would have said 40 years ago. I do not care where you come from, what kind of disability you have, if any, or how old or young you are. There is nothing more energizing or, dare I say, fun than fighting for what you believe in. So if you want to make change, change that you yourself want to see, jump into the electoral process at any level, whether it is at school or your city or in larger venues. I had my first letter to the editor published at age 5. My son gave his first testimony in support of teachers at age 7. We all can make a difference, even if we do not always realize how much of a difference we are making.
Coleman, do you have an introductory statement you'd like to make?
Hi, my name is Coleman Watson. I am a man. I am about my 40s. I am biracial. I have a blue shirt on right now, and I am clean shaven in my face. I decided to run basically because of my stroke, which I had about almost 2 years ago. And I lost my ability to talk suddenly that day when I had my stroke. And then I got, I discovered I have dysphasia. So it was very hard and humbling for me because before this stuff, I was, I still am an attorney, and I was really passionate on pro bono issues because I have been helped many clients that have disabilities themselves. But I thought I will be always on the other side on the issue as the attorney. But life does things when you know, and suddenly I had got a disability myself. I actually have been a long supporter of people with disabilities. And when I decided to run, the reason I did is because I didn't think that a lot of people would actually care for the issues for dysphasia and speech disorders. So I decided to run for U.S. Senate. I know it's a long cast, but my prior career was focused on federal issues, statewide. So I thought it was the best way for us to involved for politics, and also trying to help others like myself and others with other speech disorders also.
Good afternoon from New Jersey. Image description. I am a Afro-Latina with curly hair who is also wearing a blue shirt. I have a snowy background because I love the winter season. I will keep my statement brief. Growing up, I knew that I wanted to run for public office, and I still do. I even ended up participating in a Writing Start program and intern at Emily's List during my time at American University. But I also remember that people used to give me the advice to fix my voice in order for people to take me seriously. I was a kid at that time. However, this was the earliest example of ableism I encountered in my life. Seeing all of the panelists and moderators on this call today gives me hope. It made me feel seen. These are the role models my younger self needed. So thank you all for sharing your story about running for public office with a speech disability.
Good morning from San Francisco.
Good morning from San Francisco.
I'm a 48-year-old white woman.
I'm a cis 48-year-old white woman.
With long wavy brown hair.
With long wavy brown hair.
And I'm wearing a black shirt and green sweater.
And I'm wearing a black shirt and green sweater.
I am a long-time disability.
I am a long-time disability.
And domestic worker activist.
And domestic worker activist.
I got involved in the 2016 election.
I got involved in the 2016 election.
As a data entry volunteer.
As a data entry volunteer.
For my presidential candidate.
For my presidential candidate.
Because I wanted someone who shared my priorities.
Because I wanted someone who shared my priorities.
After the 2016 election.
After the 2016 election.
I decided I wanted to get more involved.
I decided I wanted to get more involved.
In California party politics.
In California party politics.
I was appointed delegate.
I was appointed delegate.
When there was an opening.
When there was an opening.
With my local very Democratic congresswoman. In July 2017.
With my local, very Democratic congresswoman in July 2017.
I think at first I was tokenized.
I think at first I was tokenized.
And seen as just the delegate with a speech disability.
And seen as just the delegate with a speech disability.
However, the party leadership in my state.
However, the party leadership in my state.
Really believes in my leadership.
Really believe in my leadership. And
potential.
Potential.
And these the skills I bring to the table.
And sees the skills I bring to the table.
So that has made so much of a difference.
So that has made so much of a difference.
And there has been ableism.
And there has been ableism.
But when I shut it down.
But when I shut it down.
Allies also speak up.
Allies also speak up.
And I think it is. Point.
And I think at this point,
my disability is a bit secondary to delegates and others in the party.
My disability is a bit secondary to delegates and others in the party.
I do have some aspirations.
I do have some aspirations.
Of holding public office myself.
Of holding public office myself.
So I'm so glad to be able to moderate.
So I'm so glad to be able to moderate.
Sasha, do you want to begin asking some of the questions at this point?
Oh, I thought you were doing another, one leg and, what are the major reasons you run for office? So you run for office.
What are the major reasons that made you run for office?
Yeah.
Hi, India again. Anyone that is around me even for 5 minutes knows that equity has always been part of my life's work. And why it wasn't just at the top of my list of issues on my campaign website, but integrated into every other issue I have spent years advocating for. The inequities for students of color, especially students of color with disabilities, can be found everywhere from discipline policies and treatment by school resource officers to transportation to bullying to mental health resources to what schools have cell phone towers and which do not. Yet the issues themselves were not what made me run for office, since I knew I would be fighting for our kids and teachers no matter what. The main reason I ran for office was people kept asking me to. And it got to the point where I realized two things. One, that everything I had been doing since I was in elementary school was directed at supporting our youth in public schools. And two, if I didn't run, who is going to be that voice for everyone pleading for change, for transparency, for turning all these aspirations of high quality education and a safer school system into reality? Not to mention, I thrive on new challenges, and given that this was the first time my district was going to elect someone to our Board of Education, after years of appointments by different governors, the time was right to jump in the race and finally direct all my leadership skills and knowledge and passion to support the people of Annapolis, the city I have believed in since I can remember.
Carmen, do you want to answer?
Sure.
Yes. As I said on my opening statement, I have a good passion for pro bono issues. As an attorney, I took many cases from federal prisoners, because I thought there were not a lot of attorneys that helped them. So when I had my stroke, I really understood that there are not a people that will help you for many issues. So when I was trying to recover from my stroke, I really, really needed help from the social conciergerie office. But I have been waiting for almost 2 years for no help. I started a documentary myself about Avasia, and I started to record all of my calls with the office from the social Siskoshi office, because I really want to see if a real person will actually answer my issue. But every day I got voicemails, and a lot of them I couldn't understand. And I stopped at 28 times from the social security office. And we had to get an attorney to help me. The only thing I got from the office, this basically just said, I don't have disability and I am denied in full. So then I was thinking back to my prior cases with a federal creditors when they felt so helpless, and I felt the exactly the same for them, because I never got a real person for the office, and it was very hard for me to understand the words. So I decided that I was going to run to do something about this, raise more awareness for aphasia and other speech disorders. So my story actually started because I was denied for social surgery, and I'm still waiting, and who knows if I will get it. I, as I said in the first statement, I know it was a very tall order, but I know there are not people to actually care about this issue, and that's why I had to do it. So, great.
Thank you both for sharing some of the reason why I decided to run for public office. And, oh, by the way, this is Angelica speaking. And my question is related. Who we are, and therefore our views on public service, is shaped by many factors: our race, disability, sexual identity, culture, family, and many influences. What has informed who you are, and why do you believe you will make a good public official?
Thanks, Angelica. Your lean actually represents why I always believed I brought the full package to be the kind of public official we want in office. It wasn't just my extensive knowledge and experience in law and policy, nor decades advocating on education and human rights issues, nor is it even the fact that I wanted to go into public service from the time I can remember, as I started to memorize the election requirements in the Constitution at age 6. But I come such a diverse set of characteristics and experiences. Whether it was my parents struggling with low-paying jobs or unemployment as they tried to provide for me, being one of the only white families in what used to be an almost all-Black community, exposure to multiple religions and multiple political views, plus my ability to talk to anyone of any age about anything. And so I feel I not only can listen to my community's needs, but actually understand what they are, and the urgency in meeting the needs of those around me. The fact that I am not a constant talker and actively listen also helps build up that trust with others. And at the end of the day, as complex and whacked up as politics can be, a great public official is someone who can sustain that level of trust with those they interact with, which I always knew I could and would do. Coleman, the floor is yours.
Thank you. It's Coleman. Well, for me, I think my path has been very similar because of public service. Because I, when I went to law school, I went there because I believed in the law. As an attorney, passed the bar, I was so excited to meet other, attorneys and also judges. But I quickly realized in my district that most of the judges were white men. And there are only few women at all. And there are only one minority there in that district at the time. And I thought that was very interesting for me because I always thought the law was to be equal. And when I see judges, other judges on the same district, and it feel the same type of the person, I don't really feel, I mean, they don't have to say that, but in my mind, I feel like it was not equal for a lot of the issues and for my attorneys. One of the humbly things to say as an attorney, when I meet another, a new client, they usually ask me the first question they really want to answer. And what they say is, what is the judge? And so, his name is this. And they want to know about if he was white or woman, minority, or anything, you know? But I started to look at over the issue for a lot of other districts in our surgics, yeah. there was very, there's not a lot of diversity at all in the law for judges, especially for judges. And I guess when I started my career it was 12 years in my career. Every year I felt there was a ambivalence in the room because it didn't feel it's very equal for all the issues. And so I think I wanted, actually before my stroke, I really wanted to help to pick other potential judges in any district in Florida. But it's never militarized at all. But one of the ways we can do this is to include more issues, not just like white and black and women, but we also for disability. I have never saw any federal judge to have a disability at all. So again, when I look at the bench, and we are trying to handle for all the issues, but we don't feel that we have a voice for people who actually understand the issue. It's very easy to say, oh yes, I support people who have disabilities, but it's very different to actually have one. But it's very, I guess, the thing I wanted to say that we need more public first severance for judges. Because they have a lot of enormous power on their lives, and we need more reparation for this every state.
Angelica, do you want to weigh in on this?
I have no comment besides the fact that I think it's really important in all levels that this should supposed to have reputation, especially for people with disabilities, because their lived experience really does matter in how it shaped the countries and the laws and the policies, including in the legal system. That's what I'm actually learning right now in my fellowship program.
And that's wonderful.
That's wonderful.
And yeah, for me, I think me being involved.
For me, I think me being involved.
In party politics.
In party politics.
Not only as enabled me to become more involved.
Has not only enabled me to become more involved.
But I think the party.
But I think the party.
Has gotten more inclusive.
Has gotten more inclusive.
Because they had to.
Because they.
They've had to.
They had to.
I'm a part of it.
Because I'm a part of it.
And you know, the old saying about.
The old saying about.
If they don't give you a seat at your table.
If they don't give you a seat at the table.
Bring it there.
Bring a chair.
And I already have a wheelchair.
And I already have a wheelchair.
And so, you know. So, that's very easy for me to do.
That's very easy for me to do.
So, the next question is.
The next question is.
How has your speech disability influenced you?
How has your speech disability influenced you?
Both as an activist.
Both as an activist?
As well as a candidate and potential elected official.
As well as a candidate and potential elected official.
And why don't we go with Coleman first?
Why don't we go with Coleman first?
Okay. Well, for me, I didn't think I was going to be a speech activist before my stroke, because I never thought I would have an issue myself. So for me, when I decided, well, actually before I decided, I really thought of the many ways that I could raise the awareness for the issue. So about, I guess 1.5 years ago, I decided to film a documentary on aphasia, because when I learned I had aphasia, I wanted to watch any movies about the issue, because I had never, before this, I never knew the word term, a law. So when I was trying to research, there was not a lot resources to see. There was about two movies. One was not really about aphasia. It was like connected, I guess, but it was not about all of it. But the next one has, it was good, but it was a little short. But when I watched that movie, I also realized that my type of aphasia was not the same type of the other man who was on the movie. So I decided to film a documentary myself to research all of the, I'm sorry, there's seven types of aphasia. All of them, not all of them have speech disorders for this, but I decided to film this because I wanted to have a, I guess, a resource for other people who will have a stroke and who will have aphasia in the future. So I stopped it because I did, at the time, I could not read again and write or speak much, but I had a passion to do it. But I really didn't think I was going to be a affectigs before. But when I started my film, and also before I say this, it's only just me. I don't have a team to help me. It's just me filming it, audio, everything. I knew that there were a lot of people that needed help with other resources, and there were a lot of people that know how to find it. There are only about 7% of the U.S. population that have ever heard the term aphasia. And so I wanted to raise my awareness for people, because when I was in the hospital and I was learned that I had aphasia, I didn't know what to do at all because I didn't know what it was. And my path to be an aphatic was to educate others on this issue. Back to India.
In all honesty, for most of my life, I always have tried to keep my speech disability as an afterthought, except in times where I need to advocate for others with disabilities. But over the last year, I realized that by me not advocating for myself when it came to my disability, it actually harms all the others facing discrimination and abuse due to their disability. That said, while my speech disability might not have influenced me personally as a candidate, it definitely influenced how others saw me as a candidate, whether it was a positive or negative reaction. But we can get more into that later in today's discussion.
And for me. So I actually ran to be an elected delegate to...
I ran to be an elected delegate?
Into my party.
To my party?
Last year. And it was a big challenge.
And it was a big challenge?
Because I don't think anyone... At least in my area, with a speech disability, had ever ran before.
I don't think anyone, at least in my area, with a speech disability had ever ran before.
And there was a lot going on that had nothing to do with that.
There was a lot going on that had nothing to do with
and,
that.
But I lost. But I think it was a warning to the warning. A learning experience.
I think it was a learning experience.
For both me as a candidate. And also for the local party in San Francisco.
And also the local party in San Francisco.
As well as I was trying to get union support.
And
so like they would have forums. And then we had to work with that. But like, and then as an activist. Sometimes I'm not taking it seriously. No, I'm not taken as seriously. Because of my speech disability. And I'm not seen as competent. Even sometimes with other disability activists. And so that's something I always have to fight against. And Angelica, do you have any comments on this?
Well, since I didn't officially run for a public office yet, I can say to all the young people in the call, even though you may not run for a public office right now, you are running for student-run organizations. And I think from my personal experience, it's, you know, as much as I guess we encounter ableism every day and sometimes it can be exhausting, but from my personal experience from being an advocate is that I want to change the environment. I want to bring in diversity. diversity and inclusion, especially on the emphasis of disability, especially, for example, I ran a couple times in my student organization. And yeah, there's always a thought behind my head saying, what if I mess up this word? What if something came out wrong? But the thing when it matters, like, you know, our own bodies, we are, you know, we are the change, like our existence is powerful. And when I go into the room and I advocate for myself and I introduce being one of my campaigns from my student organization, like slides or scripts, everybody was walking with the ideals and concept, and you paved the way for other people. And I know this will definitely, I would take all of this, you know, experience with me to my future endeavors, eventually run for public office in like 10 or so years from now. And I think this is a good segue to this question. Let me find it. How has the public responded? The good, the bad, or the ugly to your candidacy?
Most of the time, I had no idea what was behind the different ways the public responded to my candidacy. My district had over 58,000 registered voters, and I had the whole gamut of responses, as expected in any election. The fact that I was running for a nonpartisan position added to the complexity, such as some Democrats assuming I was a conservative because I was a registered unaffiliated, or some Republicans assuming I was this ultra-liberal because I had mailed out an AAC emergency response card for COVID emergencies to all residents that included both English and Spanish Bill of the Symbols, or others writing me to say they voted for the first time ever just to vote for me because I was the only candidate they were absolutely confident in. But for the most part, one didn't know if the public supported me or rejected me because of my issues, my nonpartisan affiliation, my disability, or my family legacy in town. Back to you, Coleman.
Hi, it's Coleman. Well, for me, I would say mostly most of my time as a candidate, has it been good? There have been some times with other people on my campaign. Potential voters, and mostly the campaign for me was on TikTok. Because, back in Florida, when we started my campaign, it's very hard to have any events because COVID. So I was trying to use TikTok or videos or anything or real time, but it was really hard to meet people, real person. So when I started on TikTok, many people commented that my words were not right or something, and it felt like a joke, I guess, because the way I was talking, and I will tell you, at the time, my speech was more broken then, but every day I get more fluid, I guess. So if you back to my older videos, you can see the difference. But when people, well, for me, and I guess probably for a lot of us, when people realize your speech does not the same cadence or rhythm, for others, I think they originally see that you don't know what you're doing or you're dumb or anything. And that was I got from the comments from TikTok. My campaign team did respond on behalf for me to say, look, he knows what he's saying, but he cannot say that the word. It's very hard to him to say it. But when you have a person to see that, usually they don't respond and they go long. But I have been, I think because of this before that, I have been very open with my stroke and my speech. And that's why I think most people were, my experiences were okay and good. But as I said, there are many times when they were bad. And also, I think people will fault because my speech was, the cadence was not right, that I was probably a real candidate. And I think they probably steal that today, but I am. so I guess I try to educate other people to say that, look, I do have aphasia, but all of my intellect was the same, you know, for many years. The only difference is it's really express my words before I can say it. So I used to have long closing arguments for cases, and I didn't have to prepare or nothing because it would just go in my mind. But I'm not the same person now, and so I have learned that I'm trying to use other ways to connect others on aphasia and myself and others with speech disorders. Back to you.
When I ran to be an elected delegate.
When I ran to be an elected delegate?
I heard from some of my friends.
I heard from some of my friends.
That people said I should just be an appointed delegate.
People said I should just be an appointed
and
delegate.
And not try to run for office.
I tried to run for delegate.
And that I shouldn't try to.
And that I shouldn't try to run for delegate.
Because it would be difficult for me.
It would be difficult for me.
And so I meant, but then other people were very enthusiastic.
Other people were very enthusiastic.
And they really appreciated.
They really appreciated.
Appreciated my persistence.
Appreciated my persistence.
My attitude.
As well as just my attitude.
And so I think it just depends.
I think it just depends.
Angelica, do you have anything to add?
No, I don't have anything to add because I don't have that almost like the public perception. However, I do have to say that I remember one particular time I was running for historian for my fraternity, Pi Sigma Pi. I talked to a couple of close friends about how to go about writing a speech, how to go about creating like the slides, what I mentioned in my previous response. And I think, I guess for me, one of the biggest thing that I really appreciate is the allyship and the understanding of, you know, of that, you know, I need a little help. And, you know, when everybody comes together, we can really make a big difference. And especially in this generation, I think we're honestly, when we work together, we can literally change the world.
That is so true.
That is so true.
I think it's me, you know, how do you happen? This is related.
This is related.
How do you deal with ableism on the campaign trail?
How do you deal with ableism on the campaign trail?
And I know Coleman, you talked about it a bit.
I know Coleman talked about it a bit.
And so if you wanted to add a little more.
So if you wanted to add a little more.
Did you say me? You said right. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, again, that's Coleman. I will tell you something that when I started my campaign on TikTok, as I said, I was really nervous about ableism, like you said, because for the same reasons I said, but I started to record all of my videos, and I will all these takes, and I was so anxious to release them because I didn't think it was good, you know, and I was so honestly depressed, but I realized that when I was thinking in my mind, I said, Coleman, you are not the same person that I used to be, and just do your campaign just like you feel in your heart. So then I stopped to record many, many, many takes to make it perfect. Then I just tried to talk with other people, honestly, because my feeling, I guess, was I lost my, I guess my, so when I fear for people to say that I didn't know what I was doing, because I knew I did, but I thought that to have many, many, many takes on a video meant that I was still trying to go back to my prior life. And I said, again, it will never going to work. So this is my new normal. And I'm comfortable with this. And I think it's actually much better for people to know that the difference before me and the new me, I guess. So I still wanted to be people to understand that I could do the same things just in a different way. So that was really my experience because mostly because TikTok, because I stopped the videos. So that's why.
India.
For the most part.
For the most part, I did not pick up on ableism any more than what I experience on a daily basis. So it was mostly par for the course as I navigated my campaign. The only blatant act of ableism was a microaggression when my opponent in the general election stated in her op-ed in our local paper that if elected, she would be a loud voice for our district. And in that instance, I decided not to let that subtle jab slide by and got one of my friends who is both an actor and parent of a son who uses AAC to record a video stating why such language was intolerant and abhorrent.
Thank you, Ben. And Delica, do you have any, and you know, you can, you do have one for office, but you can talk about that experience too.
You can talk about your experience running for office too?
Because even if it's not public office.
Even if it's not a public office?
It is a stepping stone, though.
It's a stepping stone.
You know, feel free to talk about your experience as well.
You can talk about that experience as well.
And then, so do you have anything to say about this question?
Do you have anything to say about this question?
I'm so sorry. There was knocking on my door.
We were talking about how you deal with ableism.
We were talking about how you deal with ableism.
On the campaign trail.
On the campaign trail.
That's a great question, and I hear when I hear the conversation when there was knocking the door, and one of the things that I thought about, I actually wrote a blog post for Communication First about the 2020 presidential candidates. I'm not saying names, but within, I think it was the one in October. I think it's the one in October, and Twitter was running, running ablaze, but one of the things that people noted is that one of the presidential candidate has a apparent speech disability, and sometimes he stutters, and people take that as an opportunity to say, oh, he doesn't know anything, he's slipping up, and they didn't realize that one, like, you know, it's okay to have a speech disability. And two, we know what we're saying. And honestly, those comments hurts the people around you. And I know that growing up, I mentioned it in my statements, my opening statements, that these are some of the sentiments that people often tell me, saying, fix, you know, your voice, go to therapy. And the worst part is that they're trying to say these are good advice, I'm helping you. But, you know, part of ableism is that, you know, it hurts us. It's trying to deny our existence. That's why it's, you know, the work that we're doing is so important, because we had to break the stigma. We had to say that we are capable and we will win.
Yeah, that's so important, Angelica.
That's so important, Angelica.
I think for me, I just dealt with ableism by being.
For me, I just dealt with ableism by being.
On my A game.
On my A game.
And like before I would, before I had meetings.
Before I had meetings.
I would research the organization I was talking to.
I would research the organization I was talking to.
See what their concerns were.
See what their concerns were.
And then I would try to tailor.
And then I would try to tailor.
What I was saying to the organization.
What I was saying to the organization.
Then that seemed to work.
It does seem to work.
For the most part.
For the most part.
Although, frankly, I also ignored some of it.
Frankly, I also ignored some of it.
And because if you paid attention to all the ableism in the world.
If you paid attention to all of the ableism in the world.
You would get a lot done.
You wouldn't get a lot done.
And so I just kind of, I knew there were some people who would not go for me just because of my speech disability.
I knew there'd be some people who didn't go for me just because of my speech disability.
I like that kind of knew that and ignored it.
I just kind of knew that and ignored it.
Thank you so much. Oh, sorry.
No, I was just going to say thank you for you doing.
Yeah, I was going to say thank you for sharing your statement. And I guess also this question is related. Knowing what you know now, what will you say to other people with speech disabilities thinking about running in service in public office? And I think we already like hinted, you know, our potential response, but it's good to dive a little deeper.
As I opened with, run, go after your dream. Your speech disability will just be one of many things you have to take into consideration as people decide to vote for you. But like everything in a campaign, you just figure out the best way to shine the light on the advantages while being ready for any negative pushback. It is really about you and who you want the public to see you as. So decide where your speech disability is on your list of characteristics to highlight or not. Just like some people play up their past history with overcoming an illness or coming from another country or being a single parent, just as long as you stay consistent with the reasons you want to be elected. The more you believe in yourself, the more others will believe in you as well. Not to mention, having a speech disability can silence a whole room, so there is that advantage too, if you take hold of such power in the right way. All that said, I just want to add one more thing for anyone thinking of running for office. Whether you have a disability or not, win or lose, the election will have a lasting impact on your life. I lost my election, but my life got even more busier afterwards because I was able to establish that kind of trust with people I always believe is essential in any endeavor. And so a year later, I still am constantly getting asked for help advocating for a myriad of different things, or asked to take on other leadership roles such as chairing the Annapolis Education Commission, or like today, invitations to talk about the experiences. In some ways, I think I was kept busier than if I had actually won the election. Although on one final side note, I also was the only losing candidate from all the different districts up for election. To stay active in my advocacy, including signing up to give testimony at my County Board of Education meeting tonight, so there is that to take into consideration in regards to how engaged you stay after an election. Coleman.
Thank you, it's Coleman. Well, it's very interesting for me for this question, because I remember exactly the time when I decided to run. Actually, I was sitting on this steps right here, and I was talking with my friend who, in the future, she was my campaign manager. But before that, she was saying to me, she was like, you know, this is going to be hard, but I think you have a shot. In my mind, I thought, I've never saw any politician that to have a disability, I'm sorry, a speech disorder. So in my mind, I was thinking, I think I'm crazy first, but then I was thinking about my prior career as an attorney. And I said, well, I've never saw any attorneys who have a speech disorder, because usually they love to talk, you know? And so then I had to, I guess, going open my mind, because my friend says, you know what, I know that you have a speech disorder, but this is exactly why you should run. Because, you know, we have about 60 million people who have disabilities in the U.S., but we don't have not much. So you don't have a lot of elected leaders that to say that you have a disability, and also to know what it feels like. And so for me, when I knew I was going to run, and even though most politicians don't have a speech disorder, I thought, you know what? Why not? Why would not do it? Because it's not like my speech is not due. I can't go back in time because this is it is me now. And so there was no way for do practice for many years. I guess I believed in myself. And I knew that my path is to use more information, that's why I thought it was the best time for me to go, because my life is going to be the same one day or 2 years or a decade. And I think if you are a person who are looking to run, even though if you have a speech disorder, the perfect time is now to do it.
Yeah, I mean, when I ran for delegate. Even I kind of knew that I probably wasn't going to win.
I probably knew I wasn't going to win.
And that's because there was a lot going on.
Just because there's a lot going on.
And a lot of it wasn't even related.
A lot of it wasn't even related.
To my speech disability.
To my speech disability.
And with the different systems than it usually is because of COVID.
It was a different system than it usually is because of COVID.
Blah, blah, blah.
Blah, blah, blah.
Anyway, but I'm really glad I did.
I'm really glad I did.
And I would tell people if you want to run.
I would tell people if they want to run.
And to just run.
To just run.
Because you learn a lot from it.
Because you learn a lot from it.
Even if you don't win.
Even if you don't win.
And like I kind of considered it a bit of a test run.
Because I kind of considered it a bit of a test run.
And now I have a lot better idea.
And now I have a lot better of an idea.
Of what I'm going to do in the future.
Of what I'm going to do in the future.
And again, I would like to run for something, maybe like school board or something like that.
And I would want to do school board or something like that.
I don't know yet, but I know.
I don't know yet, but.
I know I want to run for something.
I know I want to run for something.
Angelica, do you have any comments?
Angelica, do you have any comments?
Yeah, I just want to add, I guess, to the young people in the audience, if you're thinking about running, run, especially during university, there's a lot of great programs if you want to get the ropes around campaigning, all the way, you know, from finance all the way down to like how to create policy agendas. I mentioned that I was part of the Running Start, Running Start program. It was a 1 day event. It was very fun. I get to meet a lot of highly efficient women who want to someday, want to run for public office. So there's a lot of resources especially in college out there if you just want to understand. And even if it's just some, I don't know, if it's even just like a small role in a student-run organization, go for it. Because every experience counts. Even if you lose, I learn more about myself when I lose than I win. So keep on building up your credential. And, you know, and also what is really nice being a part of the disability community, especially for people with speech disability, that we have each other to look, you know, to look for support, for advice. So, you know, we have a really great community. Like, you can do this. I believe in you. We all believe in you.
That's really wonderful to you.
That's really wonderful to
and
you.
And I expect you to run for something when you're...
And I expect you to run for something.
I'm a bit older after college.
A bit older after college.
And I'll be right there supporting you.
And I'll be right there supporting you.
And we're moving to question 9. The question is how it organizes our forums and debates accommodated your disability.
How have organizers of forums and debates accommodated your disability?
Have you had to educate them?
Have you had to educate them?
And how did that go?
And how did that go?
And my father did it first time to last time. We'll go with India, I guess.
We'll go with India.
Apologies for making the super short answer, but much life and life in general, I never asked for any accommodations, and organizers did not do anything for me that they did not do for others, including sending out the questions in advance to all of the candidates for all of the debates and town halls and forums I was in. The one time I did have some assistance was during a virtual meet and greet, where my hosts filled up the time talking while I composed responses to on-the-spot questions, but it was a very friendly crowd, mostly of people invited by the hosts, so worked out well.
Goblin.
Okay, for Coleman. Well, I have not had any abates yet because they're not until in about 6 months away. But I have had other media experiences, mostly because my campaign manager has been. Usually she will tell her the media outlet about Avasia and saying that if you can talk a little slower so he can understand, he knows what he is saying, but I need him to, I'm sorry, she will say, I need you to do a little slower when you talk. And they'll say, okay, they do. But what happens is they don't do it, you know. I had to use another strategy because usually I have my own whiteboard every day, like that, you know, when I was talking for any person. But I used it now for media outlets because it makes them to stop to say what I'm doing, because I mean, usually when you talk with a person, you don't have a whiteboard with them. So when you see a person to do it, it also makes them to stop a little bit to understand what the person is doing. So I have been using whiteboards really to, to make people understand that I do need a little more time to get the right word before I talk with them. So the best strategy that I have found for Avasia is this issue.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I think for me, the only thing I would say is that first I foremost time and forms.
I think the first thing that
one thing I would say is that I asked for a bit more time on forums.
I asked for a bit more time on forums.
We didn't do any debates.
We didn't do any debates.
And, I figured out.
I figured out.
And that I was actually good.
That I was actually good.
In terms of making my responses.
In terms of making my responses.
Within the time limits.
Within the time limits.
I mean, better than other candidates.
Better than other candidates.
Because I had to think about it more.
Because I had to think about it more.
And so for the last couple of forms I did.
For the last couple of forms I did.
I didn't even ask for more time.
I didn't even ask for more time.
And one thing that happened.
One thing that happened.
One time I was done with an answer.
One time I.
Was done with an answer.
Was done with an answer.
And the person who was conducting the forum said.
And the person who was conducting the forum said.
And don't you have more to say?
Don't you have more to say?
And I was like, not really.
I was like, not really.
But then I ended up getting that endorsement.
But then I ended up getting that endorsement.
And And so, do you have anything quick you would want to ask?
Angelica, do you have anything quick you would want to ask?
Not so much in the accommodation with the basin form, but for some reason, I just think about in the classroom experience. I know that for a lot of students, we had to do speeches or presentation, and what's really helpful is having extra time to answer the questions if it's possible. Students send some of their questions beforehand, so you have something to prepare. I think this is a really easy way to accommodate in the classroom, and this also translate into going on debates or speeches. So this is actually a good segue statement to our next question. Question 10. What is door knocking like? And I actually want to start off real quick. So when I interned at Emily's List during 2018, I had an experience where we all went down to Virginia to advocate, to do door knocking slash advocate for a candidate. And that was like my first time that ever did that. And I remember when we started knocking on doors, we had to talk to voters. And I was super nervous. All my words was coming out. Like, I didn't even know how to describe it. And I didn't even disclose that I had like a history with speech disability. I need more time to like process up or have a script. But the person I was working with kind of recognized like, oh, she needs a script. So she took me to the side. We talked out the pitch that I would say. And then after that, it went fine. It actually turned out to be a really great experience. So that was my experience with door knocking was like. And even if you're an intern, you can make a difference. Even if you think it's super small, I think that experience really reinforced that, even when you do door knocking, it's always good to make sure everybody is being accommodated to.
I didn't do any door knocking.
I didn't do any door knocking.
Now let's go to question 11.
13.
I'm India. India. I'm so sorry, India.
I'm so sorry, India.
I did start door knocking prior to COVID, but much like how I talked earlier about how I had no way to know why people responded to me in whatever manner they did, door knocking was no different. Anyone who has door knocked knows you get the hellos, the no thank yous, and the doors slammed in your face, and there was no way to know if people closed the door in the middle of my opening introduction because of me personally, or because they never wanted anyone at their door. It was funny because I always did my own recon prior to door knocking in different neighborhoods, and so I found it all too ironic when the door was closed in my face in the midst of my opening by a man who I could hear had been working on a project and had a dog barking, all of which is classic reasons to not want to answer the door. But it was ironic to me because I knew that family had a daughter with a severe disability that impacted her speech as well. So in some ways it was a compliment that the father did not take time to let me finish talking and just treated me as he would any other stranger at that moment. As a side note, whether the children are yours or not, the best chance of successful door knocking is if kids under 10 are doing the knocking or being the ones to write, "Sorry we missed you," on post-it notes when no one answered.
Okay, it's Coleman. For me, I had no camenzing, no door cocking, because my race is statewide. So it's not really great strategies to use that for statewide, because I will never win if I just use the door knocking. It'd be different if I was on the separate area. So for me, we decided to use like Zoom and TikTok and events to reach as much people as I can at the same time. I don't have any problem with door cocking, but again, if you're trying to run a statewide campaign, it is better ways to use more time. So that was just it was limited for me. I know at a statewide campaign, people can vote at any area we want. And that was my strategy.
So next question.
Next question.
And both from Rachel.
Both from Rachel.
In California.
In California.
And Jack.
And Jack.
He was a young person.
He was a young person.
He was interested.
He was interested.
In running for Senate.
In running for Senate.
But they have come. How have you fundraised?
How have you fundraised?
Like, and how is that gone?
And how is that gone?
Is that my question? You said?
Okay. Whoever wants to go first.
Whoever wants to go.
Okay. Okay. I will answer. Fundraising has been very, very hard for me, and I think for any person, because you need a corner for your campaign, for people will vote for you. So if you know that the other candidates will have more support, you have to use, you have to leverage your time with other types of organizations that will definitely support you. So for me, most of my issues are very progressive, like very progressive. So I'm liberal, but I think my strategy has been to use those types of fundraising tips, because I know there were a lot of people will never vote for me because they know their other campaign, the candidate that they want to support. So I had to use only the people that like my my ideas, I guess. And but I guess fundraising is the hardest type to do. So I have going to grassroots, trokely, directroots, no PACs, no nothing at all. It's only for real people. And I have been used some success for do it, successful. I would say you should do that, to know your corner, do it.
And the
thank you, Rachel and Jack, for the questions. And I just want to say directly to Jack, you just made me smile, because finally someone else has the same mindset I had when I was young and decided I wanted to be a senator and not president. Since as much as I would love the adventure of campaigning as president, I knew as a woman with a disability, I would have a heightened number of death threats, and I did not want to take that risk. But all that said, yay, let's talk fundraising, which I wish I could say in a very sarcastic tone. Fundraising is at the heart of any campaign, but the worst thing to talk about, especially if you are someone like myself who is a natural giver, not taker, and hates asking for help. So asking people for donations was the hardest thing emotionally for me to do. Yet I knew it had to be done, and so I just did it, and looking back, wish I did it more, but that was also another twist with COVID, since my opportunities to have fundraisers or ask for donations were so limited during the early days of the lockdown.
And Delegate, do you want to ask the last question?
Yes, I can say the last question, but I just want to add with the question that we're just asking. I don't have no experience like talking to like donors, but so I have a degree in philosophy, and one of the most important takeaways from my degree is that the most important thing to do is to listen to others, even if they share different opinions. And that got me through talking difficult dialogues and conversation. And hopefully people end up coming to your side. If not, it's just, you know, it's about navigating conversation and dialogue. And I think this is a skill that we should all, you know, continue to improving, even outside the campaign sphere. But yeah, so for the last question, 19, what has been the strangest thing that has happened to you when campaigning?
There were a lot of interesting moments, but I think one of the most out of the blue things was at the polls in person during the general election. And this reporter with a cameraman came up to myself and my opponent which usually would be expected, only this reporter was broadcasting to Bulgaria and wanted to hear what we thought about the national election, not our own election. So somewhere out there I was on a Bulgarian news station for 30 seconds. The cool thing is, the reporter did not even blink when he saw I used an iPad to respond to his questions.
Well, for me, actually, the strangest thing for me is that when I started my campaign, I got a TikTok account because I didn't have one before. And my campaign manager, she says, you know, I think it's probably the best ways for us to reach people, a lot of people at once. So I thought, well, maybe I will just say a video. It's only for 10 seconds. And I thought maybe I will get maybe 100 views or something. Well, I got, I got almost 300,000 views in that 10 seconds for my first video. And so I got about 10,000 followers because of this in Florida. And I didn't know the power of using for TikTok for politics, but actually is a great way to leverage people that know your story and will support you. And also it was free. So it's great to do it. So I think you should use TikTok as your strategy. But I was really surprised to know this.
Thank you, Coleman. This is Tana Szymanski again. And I just want to thank all of our participants, India, Sasha, Coleman, and Angelica, and of course our interpreters and CART providers. For this webinar today, we've gotten some unbelievably positive feedback already during the session, texts and messages that I've been getting and tweets and stuff. We are recording this session, and as soon as we're able to produce a fully accessible video, audio, and text recording of it, we'll be posting it, and we will alert you to that on our social media and in our newsletter. If you're not signed up for our newsletter, you can do so on our website at communicationfirst.org. And thanks everyone again for attending and participating. I personally enjoyed this an incredible amount. I really, really, this was great. I'm thrilled. So thank you all so much again. And hopefully we'll see you all again soon.
It was wonderful to be here.
It was wonderful to be here.
All right. Thanks.
Bye, everybody.
Thank you.